Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, y'all. Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
No, you. It's you. You do it. You do it.
Hi, and welcome to Everything is Fine, a podcast for women over 40. We are your hosts. I'm Kim France.
And I'm Jen Romolini.
And Jen, we have such a good episode today with Emily Gould.
We have such a good episode with Emily Gould. I really wanted to talk to Emily Gould. We've wanted to talk to Emily for a long time, but then she was not over 40, and our rule is only women over 40. So now she is over 40, so she can talk to us. Yeah, it's funny. She wrote a big essay about sort of losing the thread of her life and about considering divorce and all kinds. I mean, it was just a sprawling. I thought that was one of the best things I'd read in a really long time, her essay in New York Magazine. But
But this is not what I want to ask you about. Yeah. What I want to ask you about is your trip to the Grand Canyon.
My trip to the Grand Canyon was fine. It was good. It was good. Like, I will say, the Grand Canyon is fucking grand. And like, it is a moment. Like, I was very moved by the Grand Canyon, even though, you know, every sort of step getting up to the Grand Canyon is like, you know, here, spend $70 on this thing. And here's another thing you have to do. And, you know, whatever. And you're sort of corralled. And like, I went to the West Rim, which is the less frequently visited rim. But I got up to it and I was like, okay, I get it. Like, there's photos can't capture this. This is incredible. I can't believe this exists. And I had like a very moving moment. And then we stayed at like a cowboy ranch that night, which was actually amazing. Like, there was a cowboy who sang songs around the campfire, and that should be totally corny. And it was not. It was lovely. It was a delight.
I can see where that would be a delight.
But generally, I think this month I had been trying to trick myself, which I think we all do, into thinking that the self-care things I have in place to keep me from sort of teetering over the edge or losing the thread, that I didn't need them. Like, you know, you get into a stable place and you're like, what the fuck? I don't need meditation. I don't need, you know, X thing. I don't need this level of sobriety that I've been trying out. And I got back from that trip and I was like, oh shit. Like, my mental health is like, I can feel that it's teetering. So I've started meditating again. I'm just getting more sleep, you know, cutting out the weed, not drinking, like just had to like have a fucking full reset again, which I feel like is just my life, which is like always like, oh, can I push this boundary? And then my body being like, nah, yeah, nah, you can't. Nope.
And the reason why things were going well is because the meditation and all the self-care were working.
Exactly. Exactly. And the discipline and the, let me make sure I get a good walk in every day, you know, like, and get some vitamin D. And then you forget that that's the thing that's working, and you try all your other bullshit. Then you try to be a ghoul again. And there it is. There it is, to be a ghoul. But how are you doing? That's me. How are you doing?
Fine.
Yeah.
I'm fine. I'm just waiting for spring to get here. I'm just waiting for the leaves to be on the trees again so that I can be happy.
And that's it. That's going to that guarantees it. That's it.
When the leaves come back on the trees, it's always a good day.
Okay. All right. And what about the day after? Just wondering.
Well, then there are other trees that get their leaves.
There are. That's true. I think that if that's, I feel like I can't ever count on like as soon as. I feel like if I do as soon as comes and I'm happy for 10 minutes and then I'm like, yeah, but what's the next as soon as?
Wait, I don't understand what you're saying.
Well, you're saying as soon as the leaves come back on the trees, you're going to be happy.
Oh, I get it.
And I feel like whenever I do that, that thing happens. And then then I'm like immediately like, oh, well, that was a rush of whatever joy. And then what's the next as soon as? I feel like I have to be.
Right.
I feel like that never works for me. But it might work for you. We're all different.
So we are. Should we get into this episode?
Yeah, let's get into the episode. Our guest today is Emily Gould. Emily is a features writer at New York Magazine, where she writes, among other things, Going Through It, a compulsively readable advice column. Previously, she was an editor at Gawker and a publisher of Emily Books, an imprint of Coffee House Press focusing on women's first-person writing. Emily is the author of the novels Perfect Tunes and Friendship and the essay collection And the Heart Says Whatever. Welcome, Emily. Hi.
Hi, it's so good to be here. I'm such a fan of the podcast and both of you guys. And I actually just finished reading Jen's book.
Oh,
amazing, right?
And I loved it. I loved it. And I told everyone at New York Magazine about it. And I want them to excerpt the chapter about you working at Lucky, because I feel like that is the, I mean, you know, unless you have other plans for excerpting it. Because I felt like that was so juicy and delightful. I'm obsessed with that period of time because I feel like I started my career in publishing and media, like just during the sort of like tailwinds of a time when magazines were very glamorous and important. And I feel like I just missed it.
You did just miss it because I got the very, very tail end. Like I got from like 2000 to 2008 and that was it. Like if I had been there in the 90s, my whole life would have been different. Like it's like
I was there in the 90s. Now I'm wondering how my life would be different if I hadn't been there in the 90s.
Well, you wouldn't have as much money.
That's the
bottom line, because after the 90s, it was just, especially into the 2010s, it was just scraps. It was just fucking scraps. I mean, sorry to say to everyone who wanted, had a dream of publishing. And also we were pushed in every rom-com that like magazines were the place to be. And like, we got there and it was like, wah, wah, no.
Well, the person I really feel bad for is my stepson, who's about to graduate college and wants nothing more than to be an editor.
We need editors. I mean, they're sort of not making editors anymore.
Yes.
True.
It's a real problem.
True. It's a big problem.
I hope his dreams come true, because there's nothing we need more. And I hope he gets mentored by someone who is an old graybeard at one of the, you know, four magazines that still exist.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, yeah. Like my husband.
I do too.
Yeah, my husband the other day, I was like, you know, you could dye your beard. And he was like, get the fuck out of here. the reason we wanted to have you on is because you're doing such amazing work right now. Like, I think you're doing the best work of your career, really. I mean, really, the essay you wrote about divorce was so just stunning. It was so, I mean, this is a corny word, but it was so brave and honest. And I related to so much of it. And I'd never seen marriage sort of and breakup of marriage sort of communicated in that way in the lore of divorce. I thought that was such an interesting angle, and like the accountability you took. People don't take that kind of accountability in writing. We're always trying to make ourselves the heroes, you know? So how are you doing, by the way? There's a lot about your mental health in that essay. How are you?
Well, I'd like to thank pharmaceuticals and therapy. I go to therapy twice a week, and I see a shrink once or twice a month. And I see a couple of therapists once every 2 weeks. And I spend as much money on my mental health as I spend on rent. And that's just how it's got to be right now. Yeah. Just to sort of do the routine maintenance on my brain. And of course, I take like a big handful of pills every day. I think I mentioned that at the top. But no, I think work has been really good for me. I mean, I'm speaking of magazines, I feel like I'm really lucky to have like one of the last jobs in media, and every day I'm terrified of it going away. But knock on so much wood, New York Magazine seems to be doing well right now. We're even hiring, which is bananas. Wow,
amazing.
Yeah. So I just, you know, have high hopes for this little chapter of my career of having a full-time job. I do have to write a book and have a full-time job simultaneously, so we'll see how that goes.
Oh, it's the worst. It's the worst.
Yeah, I haven't even really started trying to do that yet. I'm hoping to be able to carve out a little bit of time this summer to like go away from my family and just work on the book, but we'll see.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk a little, I just wanted to mention for the listeners who may not have read the essay that you wrote in New York Magazine about divorce, that you open it by having a breakdown, basically, and ending up in a hospital. What was it like? People are still so phobic about mental illness. What was it like for you to share that?
The process of writing this essay was really complicated, and I spent a lot of time working on it with my editor, who I think like took really good care of me during that process. Shout out to my editor on that essay, Marissa Carroll. She really guided me through. You know, when I set out to write that essay, I had pitched it as there's this whole raft of divorce books that are coming out, and I'd like to sort of group them all together and write about my experience of reading about them at a time when I was like going through something similar in my own life. So I'll sort of like weave my personal experience into the experience of reading these books. And I turned in a first draft that was what I just said, like sort of 80-20 divorce books to my personal life.
Yeah.
And I got it tossed back to me with the editorial note, like, okay, can you just like flip the ratio? Which I should have known that would happen once I had opened that door to writing about this really tumultuous and horrible time in my life when I had a manic episode for the first time, the first time in my life that I had actually become like, I mean, I was really not in control of my faculties, and I had to, like you said, I had to be hospitalized, and I was in the hospital for 3 weeks, which was the longest time I've ever spent away from my children, who were 4 and 7 then. They're now 5 and 8, so that was really difficult. And I was also really convinced at the time that I was like imminently divorcing my husband, and that he needed to like move out of our apartment as soon as I got out of the hospital, and that he was just this horrible person who had emotionally abused me and had sort of made it impossible for me to have a career, and all of this stuff that was like, you know, some percentage true.
Yeah.
But like not
right.
Really, it had become, it loomed so large in my completely insane mind. And then after I got out of the hospital, I still really felt like I wanted to get a divorce. And it took me months to sort of reconcile with my husband with the help of really like the world's best couples therapist. And it required a lot of compromise on both our parts, but also just a ton of patience on my husband's part, because he really was there for me at a time when I hated him. You know, he took care of me at a time when I couldn't stand the sight of him.
Yeah. He knew you weren't yourself.
Yeah, he did. And he trusted that I would come back to being something more like the version of me that he had known for at that point, like 15 years,
right,
at a time when like I didn't even know whether that was possible. And then this isn't in the essay, but I should also mention, because I think it's not really well understood when people are talking about bipolar, we really think of the manic aspect of bipolar, and we don't really think of the depressive aspect of bipolar as much. But after my manic episode, I had a few months where I was still like, maybe like a little bit like mania tinged, came down from that and was sort of like at a sort of baseline-ish state, sort of leaning towards depression. And then I had to go off the drug that I was then on, Lamictal, because I had an allergic reaction to it, full body Lamictal rash.
It's a deadly rash.
It can be fatal, yeah. So I had to go off it cold turkey, which was really horrible. And it plunged me into this, I mean, I thought I had experienced depression, you know, earlier in my life. And none of my previous experience even came close to touching the sort of just like blankness and blackness that engulfed me. For a long time, I couldn't even watch TV. I just lay in bed and stared at the wall. It took weeks for me to even be able to like watch Girls 5 Eva. And so I had to take a second medical leave from this job that I had like not even been at for a year. And thank God they were really understanding about that. But I had to take time to recover from that depression, which was just so crushing. And, you know, the thing about mania is that like, it's kind of, at the beginning, at least, it's like kind of fun.
Yeah.
As a fellow bipolar, I would say that the mania is not only fun, but it's also really dangerous because you think you're so great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I felt like nothing could possibly ever go wrong in my life. And because of that, I was just like a danger to myself. I mean, I could have died a million different ways during that time. I was also drinking like a fish. I mean, I was really out of control. And then the depression was just like that, but inverted. You know, nothing in my life felt like it could ever be right again or ever be fixed. And every terrible thing that I'd done and said during the manic episode just like haunted me. I felt this like deep, intractable remorse. And I felt like nothing could ever be like healed or fixed, that the relationships that I had damaged during that time were just like irreparably broken.
So you must have felt a lot of shame.
Oh, yeah. So much shame.
Yeah.
And my husband was also there for me through that period and really took care of me and also took care of our family during that time. I mean, for a long time, I really couldn't do anything but the basic rudiments of taking care of my kids. And I just couldn't feel anything towards them. You know, I went through the motions of parenting them, but I just like couldn't feel like love for them during that time. Because I couldn't feel anything except for this like deep, horrible, intractable sadness.
Wow.
So that was just this really, really dark time. And then I sort of emerged from it incredibly gradually, you know, over the course of months. Going back to work was something that I did before I felt like quite ready to do it, but it was actually so helpful to me to go back to work and just to have that structure and just also sort of have part of my identity back. You know, part of the depression was that I really lost my ability to read and write.
Yeah.
And getting that back and sort of getting back the part of my identity as someone who's constantly reading and is always in the middle of like three or four books at once was huge for me and so important. And also just having the sort of sense of community of like, I mean, my office, like most offices, is like still at about like 50% people like coming into the office now.
Right.
But I love coming into the office. Like I love going to meetings in person. I never want to go to a meeting on Zoom, you know, I could be there in person.
Yep.
I think like more people should come into the office.
Yeah.
At this stage in the game.
I'll come in. I would love to have an office to go to.
It's great.
I'll come work in New York.
Yeah, come on down. Like, you know, we've got some string cheese and there's coffee.
I wanted to ask, because part of not to dwell just on your mental health crisis, but I did want to also point out that it happened for you and was kind of public. I mean, when the Page Six announced that you were going to get divorced, and then Page Six announced that you were not going to get divorced, was that just surreal?
So nuts. I mean, because like, I'm not famous. I'm really not. I'm sure people read that who have no idea who the fuck I am and were just sort of like, what? Like, why is Page Six reporting on this, like, poor woman's, you know, mental health crisis? It just seems so weird. And so there just must be like some, I'm guessing there's like someone who still works at Page Six from like the ancient regime that remembers me from like Gawker era, who just still like has it in for me.
Yeah.
Because that's the only explanation that I can possibly think of. I really can't stress enough how incredibly not famous I am. Like, yeah. I've never had anyone like come up to me on the street and be like, "You're Emily Gould."
but you did have a certain, you were like what I used to call famous in Midtown.
I mean, it's very generational. I had the experience of teaching undergrads at Columbia creative writing for a little while after my first child went off to daycare. It seemed like a good sort of like getting back into the real world of people who have jobs kind of like gig. And none of those 20-year-olds knew who the fuck I was or anything that I had ever done. I was just their creative writing teacher. And it was like a real blow to my ego. I had to like kind of get used to that. And meanwhile, they were like, "Oh my God, Gia Tolentino is coming to speak on campus. Oh my God. Do you think she'll let me like talk to her? Or do you think she'll like, you know, sign a copy of my book?" And I'm just like, "I'm right here." Like, I can hear you.
You know, speaking of that, I was thinking about one of the things I really identified with in your essay that I haven't seen many people write about is about professional jealousy with a writer spouse, because it's something I've 100% experienced. And it kind of was something that sort of set you into a spiral. Your husband is a writer and he wrote a book about one of your children, right? And if the book was really well received and he, you know, was pretty successful, how have you come to a level of peace with that professional jealousy? Like, how are you today with it? It's really hard. It's really hard to have a fellow writer as a partner, I think.
I mean, I know that you feel me on this because I've read your book, Jen, and you talk about this a lot in your book. And you even say in your book that you think your husband is a better writer than you are and just like more talented than you are.
He is. It's okay. I mean, everybody's different kinds of writers, but like he is.
You say that as though there is a talentometer somewhere that you can measure.
I mean, the way that I've come to terms with it is that we're on the same team. Like, the goal is for like the family as a unit to succeed. And so like his success is my success, and I have to just like get on board with feeling that way. Right. I also think it's helpful that like, apart from when he strayed into my lane and wrote this sort of like mommy blog book, he really doesn't do a lot of first person writing. He usually filters his experience into fiction and writes sort of fiction that draws a lot on his life experience. And it's the, you know, and so, and we both do that actually.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's tough. And I have had the experience, you know, of going to parties with him and being totally ignored while people want to talk to him and being introduced as like Keith Gesson's wife. And it sucks. And it's just, you know, it's a very gendered thing too. But yes. Like, I think maybe the difference, Jen, is that like, I don't think I'm a less talented writer because like, I think we do really different things. And I think there are things that he's much better at than I am. I mean, he literally teaches magazine journalism, and I every time I write a profile, I feel like I'm doing it for the first time. You know, there's just stuff that he, that comes very easily to him that he, that still feels really tricky to me. And I also think that he, you know, he's just older than me and more established in his career. And he did all the things, you know, he went to Harvard and then he went to Syracuse and got an MFA. You know, he studied with like George Saunders and Mary Carr. And I didn't do any of that stuff. I just graduated from, you know, kind of not that respectable of a college. And then just, I just worked. I just did all these internships at magazines and publishing houses. And then I just was really eager to get out there and work. And I didn't want to go to graduate school. I just wanted to have a job, you know? Right. So I worked at a publishing house instead of going to graduate school or doing anything like that. I don't know. It just didn't feel like an option for me. Yeah. So he's sort of like better credentialed than I am. And like his CV looks a lot better than mine would. I would hire him before I would hire me if I were, if both of us were applying for the same job, which would never happen. There's also stuff that I can do that he can't do. I think I'm a much more sort of like spontaneous, quick-witted, responsive type of writer.
Yeah.
And I have more ideas. And I also am not attracted to the same kind of journalism that he's attracted to. I mean, I'm not going to any war zones, you know. It's, he went to Ukraine, you know, like 3 years ago. I'm just not, I don't want to go to Ukraine at all.
No, I'm always interested in two creatives' relationships because I do think there's only so much time and there is like always sort of, there's all kinds of battles too, like who gets the time to work on their work, who gets, you know, all of it. It's a different kind of thing than if you're married to somebody who's like, you know, working in a bank.
And I'm sure it all complicates once you have children. Like whatever creative rivalries, whatever time crunches there are, just get that much worse. I mean, I say this as a childless person. I know that's a very obvious thing to state.
No, but it's because the domestic duties do fall in on women still more than men. And so that then you get into that sort of inequity as well, I think. And I think you've written this too, Emily.
I wanted to ask you, Emily, because you wrote in that piece you wrote about your marriage crisis, you quote Liz Lenz as writing, "I didn't want to waste my one wild and precious life telling a grown man where to find the ketchup. What was compelling about my marriage wasn't its evils or its villains, but its commonplace horror." That commonplace horror seems to me, at least a little, to be the result of the stubbornness of traditional gender roles, which seem to persist even in 2024 and even when we marry feminist men. How do we exit that dynamic? Emily?
Emily, tell us.
Gosh, if I knew, I would tell you. I mean, it's a lot. It's just something that we constantly have to be working on and being really specific about the fact that we are aiming for this equality, which feels really inaccessible, but that at least is like the stated goal, you know,
right.
And that we have to be on the same page about like that, like that's the that's the baseline, and then we try to actually accomplish that, and we're not always going to accomplish it because it's impossible. I mean, somebody is always, with children especially, just somebody's always going to lose, you know. The goal is just to not be the one who's always losing. Just for example, like Keith is working on a book now that requires him to take some reporting trips. And for every reporting trip he takes, I have to make sure that I am taking a commensurate amount of time away from the family to work on my book. Mm-hmm. And if I don't ask for that, I'm not going to get it. You know, if I don't like make sure that that happens, it's not going to like magically happen by itself. It's something that we both have to collaborate on, making it so that our like shared family calendar accommodates both of our needs as writers, and also just like opportunities for both of us to like have fun away from each other and away from the family. I mean, that's really hard because kids will just, they're just like little piranhas, just like forever like nipping at you, like taking like pieces of you more and more and more.
Yes.
I mean, I love my kids so much and I'm so obsessed with them, but I also really need time away from them to just like recharge my batteries, be able to be a good parent to them.
And to think and be a person, just to be, yeah, keep growing as a person and not stagnating and not just being a caretaker. I identify with that so much. Let's take a quick break from some ads. And we're back. Let's talk about Gawker a little bit.
All right.
if you want. Gawker. Sure. I'm sort of obsessed with Gawker still because I'm like, Jesus Christ. Because also nobody's really told the Gawker story as well as I want it told. You know, I think Gawker is really important. I remember Gawker launching. I remember what you were writing there. I remember everything about Gawker because it felt like a sea change when it happened, at least to me in media. But you were an editor and writer at Gawker in its heyday and became sort of a poster child, I think, for a certain kind of, you know, millennial writer, share, like first person writing. I think, wasn't there a big, what was the story? There was a big cover story of you, wasn't there? Some big
spread in the Times magazine.
That's right. That's right. I totally remember that.
Posing very languidly.
Yes. Looking very beautiful. Looking very, very, very hot.
That was like 70 pounds ago, but thanks guys.
Well, we're all different now, but looking back, how do you view that time? How does that feel to you now?
I was really young when I started at Gawker. I think I was 26.
Wow.
Maybe 25 when I actually got the job. And I sort of slid into it like I had been writing an anonymous column for Gawker about book publishing when I was still working in book publishing. And I remember seeing the announcement that Jessica Cohen, who was an editor there before me, was leaving the site and just having this sort of like little spark of a thought like, gosh, like that job's available, like maybe I could go work there, and being like, no, that could never happen. That's such a like far-fetched dream. But then I got a call from Alex Balk, who was one of the editors there at the time, and he was like, do you want to like come in and interview? And I was like, yeah, obviously. And I quit my publishing job so fast. And it felt like really this sort of triumphant moment where I got to stop being someone's assistant and go have this job where I had what felt like so much power. But, you know, it was so unearned and there was so much that I didn't understand about the actual power hierarchies of New York and media. And I really got to learn on the job. I was wrong so many times and I made so many mistakes when I was working there because we were working so fast. I mean, we were trying to crank out 12 posts a day.
Oh my God.
This dates my experience so much, but every morning I would wake up. I lived in Greenpoint at the time and there was a newsstand. There were still newsstands that sold things other than like gum and cigarettes on my corner. And I would, on my way to the subway, stop at the newsstand and I would buy the Post, the Daily News, the Times, and whatever magazines came out that day. So if it was Monday, I would get Us Weekly. I would get the New York Observer. If it was Wednesday, you know, and then I would have this bundle of newsprint in my arms as I was like going into the subway, and on my way to the office, which was in Soho, I would try to read all of that.
Yes.
On my commute.
Right.
So that I would have like stuff like ready to go at when I got into my chair at the office, and I would try to rack up like as many posts as possible so that I could take like a little breather around like 10 or so and go and get a coffee and a banana donut from Balthazar Bakery, which was like around the corner. And then I would, you know, be powered up to go on with the rest of my day. So yeah, that's my like my sort of sense memory of working at Gawker. And of course, you know, I was young, I was a woman, I was sort of the most telegenic person who worked there at the time. And no shade to my friend Dori Shafir, who also worked there at the time and is very telegenic.
But you wound up taking on this role.
She was just smarter than me about it.
Yeah.
She knew that she didn't want to have like a public persona. And
she didn't want to be exploited. Like you were exploited. No. You were totally exploited.
Well, everybody there was, I think. right?
Emily was especially.
Yeah, I don't think the male people who worked there were exploited, really.
Well, because guys being snarky is somehow acceptable, but when women are snarky, it's cunty.
Yeah. You know, I think I was so naive back then, and I sort of still subscribe to the idea that, like, all publicity is good publicity, and, like, this will only be good for my career going forward, you know, if I sort of make myself into, like, a public persona. And I was really excited about the opportunity to do stuff on TV. I thought I was good at it. Yeah. And, like, I'm really not, you know, good at being on TV. I'm sort of unmedia trainable. I just can't conceal what I'm really feeling. Like my face just, but I've tried playing poker exactly once. Afterwards, the guy who taught me how to play poker was like, you should never play poker again.
Well, but here's the thing, in those positions, because I left magazines and I went on to be a digital editor and of women's blogs, women's magazines, I mean, women's websites. And you really needed somebody overseeing those kinds of stories. They're coming out so fast and there's all this pressure to get traffic. You really needed leadership, management, editorial, whatever, who's out to protect the writer, because it's so competitive and you'll write anything because you want to get on the board, and you really need an older person, or at least I tried to be that older person who was like, you don't want to say that. Let's cut that out. And I would have young writers fight with me. I'm telling you, this is forever on the internet. And because I was always pulling people back.
I mean, I really wish that we didn't live in a world where women, the stuff that women are excoriated for writing about is just so, it's just so ridiculous to me that women don't have the freedom to really ever write in the first person except for about the most anodyne topics without someone just being like, why am I reading this? Like, why is this worthy of being published? You know, that's like the constant criticism that women
get. That's true too. But there is a thing about having time to think about what you're writing.
Oh, sure.
There's something about Wesley Morris writing about his penis in the New York Times Magazine that he's had a very long time to think about. And he's had editors and there are tons of protections in place. Than a woman for $50 writing an essay about the most painful sexual experience she's ever had. That just happened last week with very little thought, you know, and time to sort of let it, you know, just let it, just, you know, build in themselves and like understand what that experience was for them. I just feel like that knee-jerk personal writing was just really, really tough. And women, it was mostly a women's game, and it was just over. It was like, you know, I think about the hairball in the vagina. That's the one I think about all the time. I'm like, I don't know. Are you happy that's out in the world? Like, not that we shouldn't be able to write about whatever we want, but was that how you would have framed that? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. Writers weren't being protected.
That's my thing.
I mean, this is very much something that's still happening. And now that I'm older and have had more experience, and now that I'm in this sort of very fortunate position of being thoughtfully, carefully edited, and now that I know how much time it takes me to sort of like process my experiences before they're sort of worthy of being written about, it's even hard for me not to have a knee-jerk reaction when something is published that I think is like just like a dumb, not very well thought out, like personal essay by a younger woman. But I try really hard not to join the pylons that happen because I think people just don't realize the extent to which they're punching down. Yeah. You know?
You're really right.
No, but like, I hear you. We are punching down, but it's sad that they have to have these hot takes. I want everyone to be carefully edited.
Yeah.
I want everyone to have the process that white men have had for a long time, which is like, oh, let's think about this again. Let me hand it back to you. Let me, you know, let's like have some, let's have a back and forth. Let's have some rigor in this editorial process. That's what I want.
Isn't the hot take the whole problem, though? The fact that it has to be such a hot take?
Yeah. I mean, that is the
like
problem.
That. I'm thinking about that article that ran in New York Magazine recently about the woman marrying the older man.
Oh, yeah. It was like last week. Yeah.
Which got a huge amount of response. And I think is a little bit of what you were talking about, Emily.
Yeah. So I talked to that writer. She emailed me and she was just sort of like, I'm really going through it, you know. I would love to talk to you. And so I talked to her about, you know, what it's like to have a piece published that gets that kind of reaction. And I just reassured her, you know, the thing about publishing something that gets this outsized reaction on Twitter and on other kinds of like social media, and then people are writing like takes about it, is that it's over in 2 days. It really is. People move on to the next thing.
That's right.
Yep.
Like, luckily for that woman, Beyonce's new album came out and then everyone moved on.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, you say, Jen, that something is on the internet forever, but I am here to tell you that that is really not the case as someone who had, you know, has worked for all these different publications that have folded and then their archives are gone from the internet forever. And you're kind of like, oh, I would kind of would prefer that my thing still be accessible online, but I guess it's not because of some like corporate overlord's hasty decision. About
right.
That.
That's also true. Right. Right. Right.
So, you know, it doesn't have to be something that defines your career. I remember I passed on to her some advice that I got from Elizabeth Wurtzel. May her memory be a blessing. Which is that after you write something that is a controversial personal essay or opinion piece and people lose their minds over it, you should really try to follow that up with a few things that are reported and not first person, and just sort of like show your range, you know, establish that you have thoughts that are not about yourself.
Interesting.
And because that's what she did. You know, she said that was why she wrote Bitch, was because she wanted to show that she could, like, do research and, like, interview people, you know?
Yeah.
I still can't believe she's gone. It's so fucking weird.
It is really sad. It's really fucking sad. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think she was just about to sort of, like, be able to go into this whole other chapter of her life, too.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's a bummer. And she was always really good about sort of taking an interest in women who were younger writers and sort of like sharing her heart, really hard-earned wisdom with them. And that was like a really generous thing that she did.
So you are now, speaking of, you're writing an advice column.
My hard-earned wisdom.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it sounds like you do have a lot. I mean, one of the things we were waiting to have you on the show until you turned 40. We reached out a couple of years ago and we were like, oh, wait, you're not 40 yet. So like you're in the middle, just like the rest
man,
of us.
I'm 42. My periods are weird.
They get weirder.
Yeah, you're here. So how are you approaching writing the advice column? Like, what is that like? Do you solicit advice or, you know, how is it working doing that? And what made you want to do it?
I just wanted to be writing something on a regular basis that had like a rubric, but I was trying to do something where I like interviewed people for it all the time. And that was just like getting the access and planning them out in advance and sort of having a sort of like editorial schedule for myself was like such a hassle. And I couldn't sustain that cadence of doing it every week. So the advice column just seemed like so much more sustainable. It's like pretty easy to write. And I started with a batch of questions that I got from sort of like friends and friends of friends and friends of friends of friends and put out calls on social media. But now people are starting to actually write into it, which is interesting. And I'm trying to like, so it really just started and I'm trying to show that I can answer questions about work, personal stuff, like mental health, relationships and parenting. And so I have a parenting one that comes out this week for the first time. Interested to see how people respond to that. Previously, I wrote for the Care and Feeding advice column at Slate. And I did that during the pandemic. So that was a huge bummer because everyone's questions were basically like, you know, my kids really want to see their grandparents, or, you know, just pandemic questions, basically.
Yeah.
But I'm lucky that I've been getting questions that are really interesting that I feel like I can really dig into. And when I don't know the answer to something, or when I feel like my answer is inadequate, I have a bunch of experts who I can reach out to. Like, I can phone a friend, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
The first one you did, I believe it was the first one you did, about the woman who thinks that her husband is leaving her bad reviews on Goodreads.
Yes, that one was amazing.
Just unbelievable.
Yeah. No, I know. I know. I don't even know what to say about that one. Everyone has asked me who it is, and I'll never tell. But also, if I said their name to you, you wouldn't recognize it because it's not someone who, I mean, there are a lot of people writing books out there in all kinds of genres.
That's right. That's right.
Yep.
Yeah.
So how do you think your relationship to ambition has changed as you've gotten older? Like, where are you now with your ambition?
I mean, I still really want to write a great book. You know, I want to write, I think my ambition for this next little stretch of life in the sort of writerly realm of my life is to write the book that I wished had existed when I was first diagnosed with bipolar, and really wanted there to be a memoir by a woman who was my age, who was just grappling with this for the first time. And other than that, I mean, I guess, you know, I want my kids to be happy.
Yeah.
That's like huge, you know. I want everyone in my family to be healthy and happy, and that's just like really paramount for me right now. That's kind of it. I mean, I want people at my job to like be like, good job, Emily, you know, and I want to get those like work
pats on the head.
I feel like that stuff has become less important to me as I've gotten older, and I sort of have a sense of like self-worth that comes from like inside rather than just like the constant and fleeting external validation that you get from like doing a funny tweet or whatever. But that's not to say that I'm like, you know, that some sort of saint. Like, I still really crave the sort of like dopamine hits that you get from social media. But I've learned to be more wary of its dark side and its sort of addictive qualities and my own addictive nature. Yeah, that's kind of it. I can't really think of anything else that I'm lacking except for like, you know, a beautiful brownstone. But it would be great, I think, if my family could have like long-term stability, you know, financially, and just be able to know that we're going to be able to like make it and live in New York City for the rest of our lives. Cause that seems like it's, you know, still continually up for grabs. But it would be really nice if I was not the one who like helps us to finally achieve that. My dream is for Keith to eventually like stop having so much integrity and a book that's like Putin for dummies, and that for that to be like a huge airport bestseller, and then we can, you know, just, I just want us to buy an apartment. I really would like to be able to buy an apartment. Like, I don't come from generational wealth. And I'm friends with a ton of people whose parents just sort of like gave them a down payment.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And I realized recently that I have so much resentment about that. And it's so icky to talk about, but I just, I'm like, that is really gross that I resent my parents for not being in a position to like do that for me. And like, my parents don't deserve, there are so many other better reasons for me to resent them.
Right. Oh no, totally. 100%. No, but it is that feeling of like, when am I going to be able to stop hustling? There is, yeah. I have that too. And then you get into like, how is this fucking possible? How, because there are fewer like direct hits. Like it's like, it used to be, okay, if you got on staff at a magazine, like that would be a big enough salary that you could like live really comfortably, or like big book deals. It was just a different world. And I feel like now it's just like, I don't know what a home run is. Like, I don't know. And this is like, you know, two people fairly successful in publishing. I'm in that kind of a relationship, but I don't know what the home run is that hits us over into that kind of financial security you're talking about without sort of generational wealth. I have yet to find it, you know, and I've sort of played in all of the different areas that you can play. So yeah, it's fucked up.
Except TV, yeah. Jen. I mean, you haven't.
That's true.
I know, but even TV, you don't make the money you used to make. Not anymore. There was that guy on writer on The Bear who wrote about how he was on food stamps or something.
Yeah, TV doesn't make that kind of money, because the thing is, it's too inconsistent now, and the seasons are too short. So yes, TV, but I mean, I'm talking about publishing. I'm not necessarily talking about entertainment, but that is a whole thing. But you know, you get a book optioned, it's like, it's not the money you think it's going to be. It's like all of the dreams.
Like a couple $1,000.
Exactly. It's exactly. Yeah. I didn't want to say that, but it's like nothing. And then you like put 2 years for that couple $1,000s into trying to develop something, and then it goes nowhere because Hollywood's totally fucked up. No, it's a really strange thing to be in. And I understand that feeling of being like, maybe you could do it to the other person. Could you just be the one? Could you just write the Stephen King book that makes us all the money? You know, but it's all, you just keep doing at bats. You just, I don't know why. I don't know anything about sports, and I keep making sports metaphors that I don't understand at all. But like, you just keep being like, well, maybe this project is the one, maybe this one, you know, and hopefully you enjoy the work a little bit along the way.
I mean, that's really the goal, is to just like wake up every day sort of excited to do the work.
Yes.
Like that, I mean, that's my true ambition, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, and it would be nice if like eventually we could scrimp and save enough to, you know, buy like a shitty co-op in Dimmes Park.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. While still doing the work that we feel called to and that we actually enjoy. But you know, everything comes with sort of trade-offs, and I don't know. I mean, yeah, there isn't really, I don't know. Like, I feel like Keith and I are like both doing the absolute most that we possibly could. I mean, he, in addition to being a professor at the journalism school at Columbia, still does a lot of journalism. He has a contract at the New Yorker, and that's like $40,000 a year. So like, whoop-de-doo.
No, and that used to be like 200. That used to be a $200,000 contract.
That's 100% true.
And so he like has two jobs. And then in addition to that, he has to like write a book so that he can get tenure. And I, you know, have a full-time job, and then I'm writing a book on top of that. So like, we really are, there's no way we could be like, there's not some sort of like windfall that's going to like rain down upon us. We're like doing the most that we can. And it's like, so do we sock away a little bit of money every month, or do we use that money to like send our kids to summer camp? You know, like, yeah, it's not a great situation right now. I don't really, or do we like give up and move to, not even Montclair, because we couldn't afford Montclair, like whatever the next town over from Montclair is, where the schools are still decent there, like, you know. And I don't want to do that at all. I like grew up in the suburbs, and I don't ever want to live in the suburbs again in my life.
Same. I hate this. All I dream about is that I'm going to get to come back to New York, and I'm like, I have the whole thing planned. I'm like, it's Yorkville. Nobody wants to live in Yorkville. It's Yorkville. That's where we can afford an apartment. Like,
I talk about it all the time. I don't want to live in the suburbs. I need that sense of discovery. I need that, like, sort of like I leave my house and I interact with other people. The suburbs is a, because even LA is just like a big suburb. It's like, it's just depressing to me. I hate being like housebound. I miss it. I hate having to drive everywhere. I miss the energy of New York every day. And I've been here for 12 years.
Right now, the energy of New York also includes random strangers walking up to women on the street and punching them.
I know, but you know what? It's always something. They used to remember when they were spraying shit. Remember when they were just spraying shit everywhere? I was like, my kind of town. It's fine.
Oh, yeah, when they were spraying shit on the salad bar.
Yes, on the salad bar. The guy was just walking around with a shit spray bottle and like, yeah. Oh, you'd be on the street just getting, like, that's just part of the mess of living in New York. It's just,
I don't know. I'm legitimately afraid.
It has gotten worse.
All right, has it? Well.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, did you see the footage of the subway shooting that happened recently? And
yes, that looked bad.
So I was coming home at that time, and I do this weird commute to pick my kids up from school where I would take this is really getting into the weeds, but I take the 2 from Wall Street, and then I get off at Hoyt Street, and then I walk to the Hoyt Scriverhorn A and G stop. And as I was doing that weird commute that day, all the people were running out of the train station. One of them was like, "He's dead, he's dead." And I was like, "Christ, I'm gonna take the bus, I guess." That was like a little too close for comfort for me. But you know, it did not prompt me to, you know, come home and say to Keith, like, "That's it, we're packing our things and we're moving to whatever the next town."
You can't even fathom of it. It's Maplewood. It's always Maplewood. It's like North Orange. I'm always like, oh God, it is. It's Maplewood. Thank you, all listeners at Maplewood. We love you, but it is. It's always Maplewood. No, I understand, and I understand that maybe it's a fantasy, and I'm glorifying New York. But I have not stopped missing it since in the 12 years we've been in LA. I haven't stopped missing New York, and I hope to return. I understand it's rough, but like New York in the 70s that was not an easy time. There was a lot of interesting things happening. I imagine there's still a lot of interesting things happening in New York. Don't you guys think? No? Kimmy, no.
I think that young people who could come to New York in the 70s, 80s, and even the 90s and find a cheap as fuck apartment somewhere in Brooklyn or on the Lower East Side are no longer coming to New York. They're going to other cities. And if you don't have that underclass of like waiters and waitresses who are really like wildly creative people, you lose something in a city. I didn't mean to say underclass. I meant
The young people sort of like filling everything up. But wait, but Emily, you still want to stay. You don't want to leave.
I've just lived here for 23 years. You know, I can't really imagine living anywhere else. I like LA a lot, but I'm a terrible driver, really terrible.
Same.
Like, so it's not appealing to have to drive everywhere. LA is kind of the only other place that I can imagine living. I've tried to like wrap my mind around other cities in the U.S. Like, you know what? I really like Baltimore.
Baltimore is great. I don't know why we've devolved into this, but Baltimore is great. My sister lives in Baltimore and it's fantastic. I would move to Philly or Baltimore. They're both good cities. But well, listen, we have done a full hour's interview with you, Emily. You are amazing. Thank you for coming on.
I wasn't too much of a bummer.
No,
you were not.
No,
good.
This is all we talk about. All we talk about is like mental health and getting old and ambition, and that's like that's it. And publishing, you fit right in.
You hit all of our talking points.
Exactly. Where can people find you?
Well, oh, this is important. If people want to write into my advice column, it's just askemily@nymag.com. Please write into my advice column. I'm Emily Book Schooled on Instagram. That's like my main thing. And then I think on Twitter, I'm like Emily Gould NYMag. But I'm trying to not use Twitter as much these days. Trying, failing not to use Twitter as much these days. And that's kind of it. There's one specific thing. If you could like ask your listeners, I'm trying to source this story right now that is about people who were married to a man or had a long-term relationship to a man and then broke up with the man and started dating as a queer person in midlife. Mm.
I have a very close friend who left her husband for a woman in midlife. So she wasn't dating really, but she.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Send her my way.
Yes. I feel like this is common. I feel like you're going to have a million people. Yeah. I feel like in midlife women are like, fuck men, like fuck it.
I think, part of my thesis is that aging as a queer person is like so much more appealing if you have like the remotest leanings in that direction. It's just so much more appealing than aging as a cis heterosexual woman for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah, I agree.
And you know, sexuality, you know, the world of sex and dating is just one dimension of the ways in which it is just sort of like, I mean, you know, you just look at old lesbians and or older trans people, and you're just like, you are in the prime of your life right now.
Yes,
you know.
I agree.
When it comes to like hormone replacement, like who wouldn't want to go on testosterone rather than going on estrogen? You know, testosterone makes it easier to build muscle mass, and you get like really horny and angry, and whereas like estrogen, like we all know what estrogen does, it's just like boo-hoo. I've taken up enough of your time, but that's like my very specific ask is that if anyone wants to email about the queer dating article, that would be super helpful, and the Ask Emily email is good for that too.
Amazing. I love this.
This was great, Emily.
I could talk to you for like three more hours. You're amazing. I feel like we've only skimmed the surface of the things I want to discuss with you. Celiac.
I want to talk about your book forever. Your book is so great. I loved it. I couldn't stop reading it. I could not put it down. It really spoke to me.
I'm so glad. That was exactly what I was going for. I was like, I want to write the kind of book that's like a bullet that like you pick it up and you're just like, all right, I have to keep. That was like my massive goal for this book because I hate a book that's a slog. So I was like, I just want them to be able to go through it fast, you know. Also, just like the other thing of like, don't look too much, move quickly, you know. So. All right, well, I wish you every bit of luck with the book writing. Keep in touch with me because I know how it is to hold down a job and have to write at the same time and also how to carve out that time. Thank you, Emily, for coming on. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, guys. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to Everything is Fine. We're your hosts. I'm Jen Romolini.
And I'm Kim France.
If you like the show, please rate and review it on all the platforms and subscribe to the show, especially on Apple Podcasts. Google Podcasts has done something weird, so our downloads have gone down. Who knows? Everything weird is happening in podcast land. If you want to support the production of the show, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/everythingisfine. If you want to follow us on social media, we're at EIF Podcast on Instagram. We have a robust and private Facebook group. You can find Kim on her blog, Girls of a Certain Age, but it's really kimfrance.substack.com. You can find me on Instagram at Jen Romolini, and there's a link tree there where all kinds of things are there. If you want to pre-order my book, which we talked about on this show, on this episode, the link is in the show notes. The show is mixed and edited by the wonderful Natalie Rivera. Thank you, Natalie, and we'll be back next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. it, mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.